Good morning, and may it please the court. First of all, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for my rebuttal.
Okay, I'll try and help you.
Thank you. My name is William Ginn from the law firm of Leverty & Associates in Reno, and I am here on behalf of the appellants, defendant, and counterplaintiffs Robert and Gail Cimini, both in their individual capacity and as the judicial assignees of Energetic Lath & Plaster and Energetic Painting and Drywall. We typically refer to them as Energetic or the Energetic entities. They were two companies that were owned by the same individuals that operated in conjunction with one another.
And I take it they've just flat disappeared. Nobody knows what happened to them?
They went out of business, apparently, in the 2008 construction mess, as did a lot of other businesses. They do still technically exist, I know, but beyond that, I do not know. We've had some contact with the gentleman who owned the companies several years back, 5 years ago.
Were they ever served with process in any of this litigation?
Yes, Your Honor, they were served with process. There was actually the entire Nevada Supreme Court line on this case that dealt with that. They were served with the process on February 1st of 2012. In July of 2012, there's communication between the claims adjuster for Energetic and for the attorneys for Silver Star, who were the lead defendants in the underlying construction defect case. And in that, there's discussion of, hey, is this part of the other case? Is this part of the Hartman case? No, it's not. It's a completely separate lawsuit. Well, we're going to have to disclaim coverage. You do what you need to do.
So Lexington covered the Hartman litigation but declined coverage on this litigation.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead and finish your answer if you had more on that.
I
have a few questions here.
Yes.
First of all, I want to make sure I understand a couple of your arguments correctly. Limits clause doesn't say that failure to pay the $25,000 is what determines whether the excess over $25,000 is covered. Instead, it says that, although the district court read it that way, instead what it says is that there's no duty to defend until the $25,000 is exhausted and that Energetic remains responsible for the $25,000 if it fails to pay it. Is that true?
If I understand your question correctly, what you're asking is the duty to indemnify triggered by non-payment of the SIR, the self-insured retention?
Right. What I'm getting at is the coverage duty suspended until the insured actually pays the $25,000, or is the coverage duty just for the amount in excess of $25,000, regardless of whether it's paid?
Well, the insurance policy is actually made up of two separate parts, which are roughly co-equal to one another. One is the duty to defend that the self-insured retention covers. And if the self-insured retention is not paid, there is no duty to defend.
But the question is, what effect, if any, does that have on the duty to indemnify? Because I read that language the same way Judge Kleinfeld does. It seems to me that it only addresses the one but not the other.
That's exactly our reading of it as well. The insurance company was in absolute control of the language. If they wish to exclude any indemnification requirements, then that's what they would do. As a matter of fact, under Section 4 of the actual policy itself, which is not modified by the SIR, it specifically says that this is primary insurance.
The theory is then that on the duty to indemnify, assuming the $25,000 has not been paid, there was no duty to defend. The duty to indemnify is the amount of the loss up to the policy limit minus $25,000.
Yes.
Okay.
Or even perhaps not even including the $25,000. That's an issue that wasn't raised below. But certainly, worst case scenario for my clients would be the entire amount of the judgment minus $25,000.
Now let me ask you another question. As I understand it, after the Cimini's sued Silver Star and Silver Star sued Energetic, and there was a settlement, or I'm sorry, I misspoke, a judgment, at what wound up happening is that the $456,000 that was left over and that is the subject of this claim, a court adjudication for $456,000, that's not for damage to the house because that was already settled. That's for the attorney's fees and expenses of the Simonies and of Silver Star, which was assigned to the Simonies. Is that correct?
What the state court decided, excuse me, what the state court decided was that the damages were damages to the home plus the assignment damages that were in there, which was $100,000, which was paid for the damages to the home, plus the attorney's fees and costs, as was allowed under Nevada law under Chapter 40 at the time.
I'm not asking for the justifications now. I'm just trying to find out what the present judgment is for. My impression was that it's not for damage to the home anymore. That's been settled. What it's for is the Simonies' own attorney's fees plus the Silver Star attorney's fees assigned to the Simonies.
The judgment is for the $100,000 that was paid by Silver Star for damages. That amount was assigned back to the Simonies. Plus, there's attorney's fees.
So it is for the damages to the house.
It is for the damages to the house that were paid as a part of the underlying settlement.
Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
Okay. The next issue, that was the first issue, is regarding the SIR and how the SIR, in our opinion, was improperly read and applied by the district court. The second issue has to do with whether the district court improperly granted summary judgment by making inferences in favor of Lexington in this case. One of them has to do with the intention of the parties and what the parties' intention was regarding the terms of the contract, as we just discussed. Another one has to do with the August 24th, 2012 letter. We call it a denial letter. Lexington calls it a reservation of rights letter.
Well, what, it purported to be a reservation of rights letter, but there's a question as to whether, I guess it came back to the insurance company, is that right? It was never physically delivered to anybody from Energetic?
That's an issue that we don't even know the complete answer to, Your Honor, because we weren't allowed to do any discovery.
There's no evidence that Energetic received it. I thought there was evidence in the record, or at least in the claims adjuster file, that the letter came back as undeliverable.
There is record in the claims adjuster file that the letter came back as undeliverable.
What evidence do you have to refute that? Is that a material fact that's in dispute or not?
It's not a material fact that's in dispute that letter was sent out. It's a material fact that's in dispute as to what that letter was. That letter specifically says we're denying coverage. Oh, but if we're going to pick up coverage at some later point, then perhaps we're going to do all of this. And there was no reservation of rights letter that was sent when they actually picked up coverage.
I think the court below looked at that argument and said, well, even if they'd sent a second letter, given the fact that the first one bounced back, it would have been futile to send a second one because Energetic had disappeared. Isn't that what the district court said?
No, Your Honor. I believe that they said that they just said it was a reservation of rights letter and they didn't need to send a second reservation of rights letter when they began to defend, which is in violation of ample case law that's out there that says when you begin to defend, you must do this. Even if it's futile, you have to try.
As a practical matter, what difference does it make? Because there's no indication that had a second letter been sent that it would have suffered any different fate than the first letter.
There's no indication that had the second letter been sent, it wouldn't have been received either.
Well, we know that the first one was not received as undeliverable. I thought the testimony by the claims adjuster was that he tried to contact, made several phone calls, the phone was disconnected, basically had no contact with the insured from the time that letter was sent to the present. Isn't that the state of the record?
Your Honor, excuse me, we don't know what the state of the record is. All we have is a single affidavit.
Counsel, it's not a hard question. My question is, didn't the claims adjuster say, I tried several times to contact the insured and I got nowhere, no response?
Yes, Your Honor, he did say that. And we filed a 56D motion to allow us discovery to obtain the information that would support that statement.
And what would that discovery have revealed?
It would have revealed whether or not he even indeed did attempt to contact him, when they did. And it also goes to the issue.
I thought he testified, or is this just that from the notes from his file?
That's actually the statements. It's not even notes in the file. That's actually from their briefs where they say that. The only documentation that is in there is the declaration of the individual.
Dick Shaw.
Dick Shaw, thank you.
Yeah, but doesn't he say that in the declaration?
He says I did, and then I didn't bother to try it again because I didn't think it would be successful.
So that's the affirmative record evidence that's in the record. And the best response you have to that is, had we been given more time to conduct discovery, we might have been able to refute the truth of that.
Exactly.
Accusation? Is that your argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
We were not allowed to do so. We asked for discovery on that. It was all denied. We did not get to a point where we could even file a motion to compel because the motion for summary judgment had already been submitted.
And you didn't note up the deposition of Mr. Shaw prior to the closure of discovery?
We never even got to the close of discovery, Your Honor. This, when this motion was filed, we didn't even have finalized pleadings.
Was there any discovery done at all?
There was only the initial disclosures that were done, and that was it.
Depositions were taken by either side?
No, none.
Okay.
And I'm
going
to reserve the rest of my
time.
Time
for a revival?
Yes, please.
Okay, thanks.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Andrew Harold for Lexington. And as an initial matter, thank you for taking the time to hear us today. We always appreciate it.
Well, it's an interesting case, but can you help us with regard to the interpretation of the self-insured retention? And as I understand it, the insurance company elected on its own to defend, did it not?
Correct. Under the policy.
So it didn't wait for proof that the $25,000 was paid. It simply made a decision that they would provide a defense.
Correct. The insurance company exercised its discretion to defend pursuant to the terms of the policy. That language was specifically attached to the ROR letter that you were just discussing, which was, you know, likely never read by anyone.
Right.
I have a question about this. It looked to me pretty clear that there was no duty to defend, just a potential election, until and unless Energetic paid the $25,000. But I don't see an exception or an exclusion from the duty to indemnify until and unless they pay the $25,000. What I saw that was relevant to paying the $25,000 on the duty to indemnify was that Energetic remains responsible for the $25,000, the self-insured retention, if it fails to pay it. The language of that indemnity clause remains responsible if Energetic fails to pay the self-insured retention suggests to me that the best inference from it is that the duty to indemnify survives despite the failure to pay $25,000. It's just that you knock $25,000 off the total obligation. What's the matter with that?
I understand that is the position that's been asserted
Why is it wrong? I can't find policy language that supports your interpretation that paying the $25,000 is a condition precedent to any duty to indemnify. I know the district court went that way, and I can't find the policy language that supports it.
Understood. The policy language starts at the top where it says self-insured retention endorsement, and then it states that the limits of insurance apply excess of self-insured retention.
Let's make sure we're both looking at the same clause here.
That's EOR 71.
Got it.
Okay. The general rules on how that language has been
interpreted. Are you talking about the language in defense and settlement?
No, above that.
It's clause Roman 1.
The limits of insurance clause?
Correct.
Okay, where it says the limits of insurance as set forth in item 3 of the declarations, that was the million, right?
Correct.
And then it says, shall apply excess of the self-insured retention, which is $25,000.
Correct.
Okay, I don't see where that implies anything one way or the other about whether it's a condition precedent.
Understood. The California courts, and in fact this court, have dealt with this issue repeatedly.
Well, wait, when you say California courts and this court have dealt with it repeatedly, I noticed that a lot of your citations were to unpublished dispositions, which, as you know, are not binding. We can't treat them as binding law.
Understood. I'm referring to Forecast Homes v. Steadfast, which is the California Court of Appeal, when citing to Krosky and the California Practice Guide, stating an SIR is the specific amount that must be satisfied before any coverage applies. Or is...
Which case was that again?
That's Forecast Homes v. Steadfast. Or as this court stated in the Pacific Employers versus Domino's matter, it is well recognized that policies which are subject to an SIR have no duty to indemnify until the SIR is exhausted.
Now, was the policy language in those two cases identical to the policy language in this case?
Well, I'm going to say that courts, it's hard to glean that specifically from the decisions.
That's a real problem for me because you really can't say what a particular insurance policy does on the basis of what other insurance policies do.
Understood.
Because they're not standard forms.
The City of Oxnard and General Starr cases both deal with exactly this type of language where they say the limits apply in excess of an SIR and reach those conclusions. In addition, in the Insurance Company of the State of Pennsylvania versus Acceptance, it was the exact same language. Centex v. Lexington was the exact same language. And the trial court in this matter reached the same conclusion on the exact same language.
Counsel, go ahead.
Counsel, the problem I'm having with your argument is I'd like to refer you to page 72. The insolvency clause,
correct,
which makes clear that if the insured is unable to pay, it doesn't have any impact on the obligations under the policy.
Correct.
So the way I read that, and maybe I'm reading it wrong, is that if for some reason the insured just can't come up with the $25,000, the insurance company is not completely off the hook, which I think is your argument.
Correct. And I would like to address
that
head-on.
But I do think there's a difference between the duty to defend and the duty to indemnify.
Yeah. Agreed. And to hit that point head-on, that language is in there, I believe, by statute, which is that bankruptcy does not relieve an insurer of its obligations. That language has to be in the policy. That is the
public policy. If it has to be in there, it's in there.
Yeah. And it has the public policy of the state of California, and that deals
and
with...
reading the relevant parts, I have exactly the same problem that Judge Tallman does. When I read the relevant parts of that sentence under insolvency, it says, your failure to pay the retained limit will not increase our obligations under the policy. And then it says... you will continue to be responsible for the full amount of the retained limit
continue
before
that sentence.
The limits of the insurance under this policy apply. In no case will we be required to pay the retained limit. Now, when I read that word, that clause, the word that jumps out at me is responsible. I'm responsible for paying my phone bill, whether I paid it or not. Responsible means it's my liability. And I don't see why the word shouldn't be read similarly here. They remain responsible for the $25,000, but that doesn't mean that they have to have paid the $25,000.
Well, it says before the limits apply.
Well, yeah, before the limits of...
Is it possible that you have to do a condition preceding to qualify for that to be show insolvency?
It references your refusal to pay as well.
Okay. Where it says before the limits of the insurance apply, that's the $1 million limit. That's the limits of this insurance.
And why can't we give meaning to the last sentence of Clause 4 that where it reads, in no case will we be required to pay the retained limit or any portion thereof, as simply triggering a set-off in the amount of $25,000 or the balance if the insured in bankruptcy can pay some portion of it. And therefore the insured doesn't increase its obligation, or the insurer does not increase its obligations under the policy, but it doesn't excuse the insurer completely from any responsibility under the policy, does it?
No, and that is going to circle back to my other point, which is this is not a judgment creditor action. Rather, this is the insured bringing a breach of contract action.
Right.
So this language is designed to protect judgment creditors in 11580 actions.
But your argument is essentially trying to read in, as Judge Jack put it, a condition precedent that triggers all obligations under the policy, which is the payment of the $25,000. And I just don't see the language in the policy that supports that argument. I'll grant you that you may not have a duty to defend, although I think that issue is kind of moot given the insurer's voluntary decision to exercise its right to defend. So now we're just simply talking about what are the limits, if any, on the duty to indemnify.
I would say I would frame the question slightly differently, which is, do the claimants herein have a breach of contract cause of action for failure to indemnify? That's the cause of action that is brought, and that's highly significant. To establish a breach of contract, you have to have contract. You have to have the plaintiff perform its obligations under the contract. These plaintiffs effectively breached multiple of their obligations. They did not give notice. They did not satisfy their SIR. They defaulted.
Would you agree that had Energetic gone into bankruptcy and a judgment been entered against it so that there was a judgment creditor knocking on the door, in the face of this language, the insurer would still have a duty to indemnify, even though the bankrupt insured would not be able to pay the SIR?
I would say that that question is being wrestled with by courts in different ways and different fashions, and I don't actually know what the answer is going to be on that.
Well, what's the purpose of the language of the insolvency clause if that isn't the effect of it? I mean, we have to give meaning to every portion of the contract.
Correct.
And you're asking me to read that entire paragraph out of the contract of insurance.
In the context of a breach of contract cause of action, yes. I think because they are coming and saying that Lexington breached its contract, we're entitled to point to the fact that the plaintiffs, in fact, did not comply with their obligations under the contract. And they need to do that in order to state a claim for breach of contract.
Notice
the judgment creditor issue is a much more interesting, convoluted issue, but that's not what's before the court.
All I can see that is an important sort of breach that could bear on the duty to indemnify is failure to give notice. The reason for those clauses is usually to prevent collusive arrangements between the insured and the insurer, where the insured confesses to a judgment that's very high and then assigns rights to the judgment in exchange for a covenant not to execute. But in this case, that really isn't an issue. Not only
I think it is.
Well, the problem is the record seems to show without contradiction that the insurance company knew about the litigation because of the Hartman litigation, sent a question to the or exchanged correspondence with the attorneys and knew about the Simony litigation.
I think there's some loose terminology being used there. The right to repair statute is the claim that was presented by a different company to Lexington, not a suit. So that's entirely distinct. Lexington never got notice of a suit against Energetic. Energetic defaulted before Lexington got notice.
Well, wait a second.
Of the
I thought the Hartman litigation dealt with defective work on 11 other homes, and and Lexington was involved in that litigation, and that was because Silver Star had cross-claimed against its subcontractors.
In separate litigation.
And here, Silver Star had sued Energetic when it received notice from the Seminis that the work done on the home was defective.
Well, the
have I got that right?
No.
Okay.
The Samini suit The Samini suit is a separate suit.
Yes, I understand.
The Samini action was served on Energetic. Energetic defaulted.
Yeah.
Then Lexington got notice of the Samini suit.
Right.
Am I looking at the right thing here? I see this email from Marissa Pochi to Dick Shaw, subject Samini versus Silver Star. You're insured Energetic. And it says, "Hi, Dick. I am writing to request your attendance on behalf of Chartis at the upcoming mandatory settlement conference of this case, which is the Samini versus Silver Star case." And it gives them the date. And then says that I understand Chartis is not defending due to Energetic's unsatisfied self-insured retention of $25,000. So it looks as though the notice is there before the arguably collusive, or your argument is that it's collusive judgment is entered. I don't see what's missing.
Reference to the word suit by a different company that's not providing notice of the suit.
Well, it says subject Samini versus Silver Star, isn't that?
Which is a different action.
It's the basis.
Oh, I'm sorry.
For this
no, Samini is the one we're talking about. But the Samini versus Silver Star is also the reference to the right to repair claim, not the actual suit. They would be called the same thing, is my point.
It says here it's a suit, Samini versus Silver Star.
I understand she says that in the email. My point is Energetic had already defaulted, had not given notice to its insurance company of that.
But you still had notice in time to show up and prevent any collusive arrangement.
We attempted to. The court rejected the efforts to intervene and allowed the judgment to proceed.
But you didn't send anybody to the settlement conference.
We did. There's undisputed evidence in the record that we did.
I think you sent an adjuster, but not a lawyer. Is that right?
Correct. I'd like to if I could, I understand my time's almost
go
up,
ahead.
To move to the breach of the implied covenant claims. These presented the rather interesting argument that summary judgment's never appropriate in bad faith claims. The underlying court did not agree with that, but it was an interesting argument, so we went and dug it up. We found 25 cases under Nevada law granting summary judgment on bad faith claims and found that the United States Supreme Court framework for summary judgment applies equally to those types of claims as to any other claim. Lexington presented evidence as the movant. The opposing party presented none. They earlier referenced that there was a 56D request. There was not on this summary judgment motion. There was one on a summary judgment motion several months earlier. The court properly granted summary judgment on that issue, which I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I don't have any questions on that. Bad
okay. Going back to the fundamental issue that the court has inquired about, which is the duty to indemnify. We would submit with the multiple breaches established by the plaintiff of their contract that there is therefore no ability for these plaintiffs to claim breach of contract. We would also submit that the language which states the limits apply excess of a self-insured retention has been found by many courts to make the duty to indemnify subject to that condition precedent.
Okay. I think we have your argument in hand. Let's
thank you.
Hear the rebuttal from the other side.
Thank you, Your Honors. First, there was some discussion there about when Lexington learned of the lawsuit. The Seminis lawsuit was filed on October 26th of 2011. The emails.
I'm sorry, your voice trailed off at the end.
I'm sorry, October 26th of 2011. The emails that were referred to as being in July of 2012, Ms. Pacci specifically says to Mr. Shaw that Cimini is not a part of Hartman. It is the same project, but it is not a home in the Hartman case, and is a totally separate lawsuit that was filed on Cimini. So it is the same. I mean, at that point, they very clearly were on notice of that. Their letter that comes out approximately a month later also specifically references the lawsuit in it. So they were clearly on notice of a lawsuit by that point. Approximately a week after that email happened is when the initial clerk's defaults were taken. The final default judgment was not until, the hearing wasn't until July of 2013. It wasn't until April of 2014 before the actual judgment came out.
So what you're saying is they knew, and although they had no duty to defend, they had the power to defend, and they could have stepped in and to prevent the default.
Absolutely.
Now, let me ask you about something your opposing counsel said. He said there's a lot of authority, including the California Court of Appeals case, that deals squarely with failure to meet the self-insured retention and its effect on the duty to indemnify. Could you speak to that?
Certainly, Your Honor. Actually, what winds up happening then is if it is excess insurance, as Lexington argues, then it winds up being a co-insurance situation. And on co-insurance cases, the costs for both the defense and indemnity are allocated among co-insurers on a pro rata basis in proportion to the policy limits. So that's the Maryland Casualty case, which is a California Appeals Court case, the Armstrong World case.
I'm not sure you and I are talking about the same things. One kind of excess insurer is where there's a self-insured retention under an insurance policy, and the policy covers, say, up to $1 million. And then there's an excess insurer for the layer from $1 million to $10 million. Sometimes there are multiple insurers for various reasons who have to share the burden of the case. But that doesn't come up in this case. Also, I don't really care what unpublished cases say or what cases from other jurisdictions say for purposes of our discussion right now. They may be enlightening, but what I want to know now is there a California Court of Appeals decision looking at similar language that says that the self-insured retention is a condition precedent?
As was addressed in the Lexington's arguments, it's very difficult to tell exactly what the language is from all of these policies.
So the policies do not quote the relevant language?
In many instances, they do not. And to be perfectly honest, I did not go through every single case that has been cited in here to try and figure out if it says it or not.
Did you read the cases that your opposing counsel just cited to us to see whether they really do? If California law is that failure to pay the self-insured retention in a similar policy is a condition precedent that has not been met for the duty to indemnify, even if the policy language might appear to us not to support that, if that's California law, we're bound by it.
Well, Your Honor, the Pacific Employers versus Domino's Pizza case, which he referred to, which was decided by this court about 20 years ago, was a situation where they were trying to decide which policies even applied.
Wait a minute. You said decided by this court.
Yes.
We have to follow California law under Erie.
Yes,
so Your Honor. Really interested in what California law is.
And that was interpreting California law. It was a California case that had come through. This court interpreted California's laws at that point. And the issue in that one, it was a car crash case, and there were Domino's, being a huge corporation, had multiple layers and multiple different types of policies. And which policy was there, which SIR had to be paid, how it was applied. The policy language was not included in that. But in that one, they did say that they did have to cover it. They just had to make sure that the proper policies had tracked through, because there was notice issues and other issues.
Maybe now you could turn your attention to the California Court of Appeals.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that was the Vaughn's case that he was referring to. We do not know what the language was in that one. It is not. I do not believe it is quoted at all in that policy. When we were preparing the briefing, I did look at it, but I don't remember seeing any language in there in specific. But in the Aetna Casualty and Surety Company, which is a 1976 California Appeals Court case, it's the if the primary coverage is not paid, the excess coverage still needs to pay, and that would be the SIR in this instance. It's Lexington.
So you're saying Aetna goes your way.
Aetna goes our way. Lexington's argument is the SIR is primary coverage. It's the first layer of coverage. It's the primary coverage. It's the primary insurance making theirs excess. Now, I disagree that the policy even says that.
I have trouble calling a self-insured retention primary coverage.
I agree.
I mean, it looks a lot more like a deductible to me.
I would agree, Your Honor. And there's we could probably be here all day talking about the differences between.
You can say it's like primary coverage.
It's like primary.
Like companies like to say we're self-insured, which means they're not insured.
Honestly, Your Honor, we could be here all day talking about the fine intricacies between all of these different types of policies. It's kind of like primary coverage. It's kind of like a deductible. It's kind of like a fronting policy. It's kind of like self-insurance.
Insured retention is what it is.
That's
what it says. That's what it is. It's a self-insured retention of the risk of loss.
But if it were truly self-insured, then the policy would say we have no duty to cover anything until this $25,000 is to be paid. The policy language specifically says in Section 4 that this is primary insurance.
I don't know if you understand yet what my concern is. My concern is we have to follow California law, and I want to know what California law is when with regard to the duty to indemnify when the self-insured retention has not been paid, period.
All the cases I've ever seen on the issue, Your Honor, say that I'll address the duty to defend. They don't get to the indemnification issue.
Well, then certain underwriters would say if you have no duty to defend, you have no duty to indemnify.
That is actually an oversimplification of the statement, Your Honor. It is, if you do not have a duty to defend because it does not fall within the scope of coverage, then there is no duty to indemnify. So if I have auto insurance and somebody slips and falls at my home, my auto insurer has no duty to defend me in that case because there is no potential for coverage.
Any other questions? I think we are out of time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you both very much. The case just argued is submitted.
Thank you very much.
And we will be adjourned for the benefit of the high school students. Welcome. We're going to go back and talk about this case and the other cases that are on the calendar. Our law clerks are going to talk with you while we're conferencing, and then we'll come out and meet with you.
All right.